Well, as we've heard by now a few times, our theme for this Lent is Christ Collides. Let me step back a little bit and talk a little bit about how we get these themes and these different seasons. We generally, for Lent and Advent, rely on materials that are published by Menno Media. And Menno Media gets these materials by contacting people in different parts of the U.S. and Canada, and in those regions they'll gather together a group, and the group then will study the texts and develop these themes and write the resources that we use, like the calls to worship and the confessions and the suggestions for children's story and what songs we sing and all of that. And this year, for Lent, actually, the team that wrote these materials came from right here in Illinois Mennonite Conference. And in fact, we have two members of that planning team who are helping to lead us in worship this morning. Pastor Barb was the chair of that team, and Adrian was also a member of that team. So if there's anything in the materials that you have thoughts about that you don't like, obviously those were written by somebody other than Barb or Adrian, but I want to thank them for their work. Our theme for today is Christ Collides with Condemnation. Condemnation is certainly something that we hear a lot these days. Our politics are filled with condemnation. You got folks on one side of the aisle condemning the other as radical left-wing lunatics and woke members of the parasite class and crazy childless cat ladies. Whereas the other side then replies and condemns their opponents as fascist broligarchs and stupid MAGA cult members and corrupt liars. And probably most of us have more sympathy with one side of that debate than the other, but I hope we can all agree that this sort of condemnation and name-calling is not really terribly helpful if we're trying to get things done. And certainly not if we're about the work of building up God's kingdom. Well, I think in our text for this morning, Jesus provides us some helpful alternatives to all the sort of finger-pointing and vitriol that we read in the daily headlines. Now, actually, speaking of headlines, the passage references some events, current events, that would have been in the headlines of the day. The people here at the very beginning of our text start talking to Jesus about the Galileans whom Pilate had killed while they were offering sacrifices. Now, that's something that we don't know anything else about. I mean, other than this brief reference here in Luke, there's no record of any sort of event like this that we've been able to uncover. But clearly, it was a major story at the time, and it's also clearly very relevant to Jesus' ministry. Jesus is a Galilean himself, and he is on his way to Jerusalem, where Pilate rules and where this incident seems to have occurred. And so those who mention this event seem to be trying to get Jesus to affiliate with their political agenda. Hey, did you hear about what that corrupt Pilate did? He sent soldiers into our temple. He killed our countrymen. He slaughtered them alongside the lambs they were sacrificing and mixing their blood together. I mean, it'd be a little bit like somebody coming and saying, hey, did you hear what that corrupt Trump did? He told ICE that they can go into places of worship and try to arrest undocumented immigrants, violating the very sanctity of our own churches. And they might expect a response like, yeah, I mean, I can't believe all the crazy stuff he's doing, like that stupid stunt this last week where he let Elon Musk turn the White House lawn into a showroom for his swastikas. But Jesus doesn't take the bait. He doesn't continue down that road toward condemnation. And instead of focusing on Pilate or the admittedly cruel acts that the Romans perpetrate, he turns the attention back to those who make the inquiry. So these Galileans you mentioned, you think they were worse sinners than any other Galileans? And then he starts talking about another incident, something else that we know nothing about but must have been in the news at the time. What about those 18 people who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them? Do you think they were more guilty of wrongdoing than everyone else who lives in Jerusalem? Again, it's like somebody talking about, complaining about the government's policies towards immigrants, and Jesus would respond by saying something about the plane crash in D.C. a few weeks ago. The two events are completely unrelated, except for this. There are innocent victims involved in both of them. And so Jesus turns the focus from casting blame to empathizing with those victims. Rather than castigating an easy target like an unpopular leader or some faceless institution, he challenges his listeners to look inside themselves for the root causes of so much suffering in the world. Unless you repent, he says, you will suffer the same fate yourselves. You're no better than they are. You each have done things for which you need to apologize. You each have your own sins that you need to disavow. You have things in your life you need to change, and those are the things you ought to be focusing on, rather than fixating on the headlines, becoming preoccupied with blaming others for tragic events that, frankly, you have no control over. And then he tells this story. A story about a gardener and a fig tree that won't produce fruit. It's a story about patience. It's a story about waiting. It's a story about delayed judgment. And rather than simply being chopped down for not bearing fruit, the tree is allowed this extra period of time, this grace period, where it's allowed to continue. And instead of rushing to condemn the tree for its lack of performance, the gardener gives it special attention. Gives it extra fertilizer, space to grow. One commentator sums up the lessons from all of this in the passage by saying this. He says, we live in a day not so unlike that of the atrocity rumoring Galileans, when everyone wants to blame everyone else for all the ills of the world. Christians blame Muslims, and Muslims blame Christians. Fundamentalists blame Hollywood, the ACLU, and homosexuals. Liberals blame fundamentalists, militarists, and pharmaceutical companies. And amid the din, Jesus says, hold on. So just when we begin to stir up flattering, heroic images of ourselves in full battle dress, ready to wipe evil off the face of the earth, Jesus knocks us off our moral high horses. He brings us down to earth, back to ourselves, with talk of fertilizer and a scruffy tree. As we jump into the second part of our text for this morning, we find another group of people coming to Jesus and talking about another political leader. This time it's Herod. Herod is the ruler of the region of Galilee where Jesus is from. And some Pharisees come to him. They warn him that Herod is looking to kill him. Now, this was a very, very realistic sort of threat. I mean, the same Herod, he's the one who has already beheaded John the Baptist. But Jesus dismisses their concern, just disdainfully refers to Herod as that fox. Now, in Jesus' time, you have to understand, foxes were seen as relatively insignificant creatures. They're more of a nuisance than really a threat. They're viewed as pests, not so much predators. And so Jesus is saying, well, Herod might be kind of annoying, but his threats are not going to keep him from doing what he's going to do, which is throwing out demons and healing people today and tomorrow and the next day and then heading on to Jerusalem to finish his work. Okay, wait a minute, though. Isn't Jesus doing here what I just said isn't very helpful? He's calling his adversary a name. He's belittling him. And if this were the end of the story, one could certainly make that case. But the passage continues as Jesus turns not towards condemnation, but instead towards lamentation. He mourns, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who are sent to you, how often I have wanted to gather your people, just as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you didn't want that. Now, this movement from anger to lament, I think, is a highly significant one. And it's not a movement we typically see played out in our times. More often, the anger that is expressed simply snowballs. It gets larger and larger in these echo chambers where enraged voices just amplify one another. And left unchecked, that sort of angry condemnation results in deadly events Things like the storming of the Capitol building, January 6, 2021, or the attempted assassination of Donald Trump last summer. It is precisely this cycle of anger and violence with which Christ collides through his lament in our text today. Drew Strait is a teacher, professor at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary, and he's become one of the nation's foremost experts on Christian nationalism. And Christian nationalism is a movement that really thrives on this cycle of condemnation. On the AMBS webpage, Drew describes it this way. He says, Christian nationalism exchanges the church's loyalty to the Lord of peace for a false god fashioned by the myth of American exceptionalism. Christian nationalism is a form of political idolatry that distorts our knowledge of God and neighbor through a xenophobic, racialized, militarized gospel that is at odds with the life and teachings of Jesus. Now, Drew spoke recently at the annual assembly for Illinois Mennonite Conference, and there he shared from his recently published book. The book is called Strange Worship, Six Steps for Challenging Christian Nationalism. And one of the steps that he writes about in that book that I'd like to focus on this morning is to check our postures and harness our anger at injustice in lament. And he explains what he means, writing, he says, I know I'm not alone in experiencing the catharsis of late-night parodies and tweet storms against toxic Christianity, but does any of this move the needle towards changing minds? Or worse than that, does it have the opposite effect of polarization? How do we harness our anger against injustice and leverage that energy for the common good? He continues, the biblical tradition of lament affords us the proper posture of protest for challenging Christian nationalism. Lament is an act of talking back to God that empowers us to tell the truth about injustice. It provides us a space for harnessing our anger at theologies of oppression and converts it into lament, a precursor to action. Now, Drew's words are directed specifically towards Christian nationalism, but I think they're true more broadly in various ways to the teachings of Christ collide with words and actions of condemnation. We see, I think, an example of what Drew is talking about here in Jesus' response to the warning about Herod. Jesus begins by expressing anger. And there indeed, there's a place for righteous anger. Anger at political corruption. Anger at violence. Anger at this man who is responsible for taking the life of Jesus' friend, Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist. And so Jesus doesn't shy away from declaring his anger toward that fox Herod, but he does not dwell in that anger. He does not let the anger control him. Rather, he takes control of the anger and turns it to lament. As Drew describes it, lament is a biblical tradition, or what some call complaint prayers, that offer a dynamic liturgical tool for addressing harm and injustice. Through lament, God offers an ancient way to talk back and complain to a listening ear about injustice, abuses of power, idolatry, exploitation, and even feeling of God's absence. Lament invites God into our pain and implores God to act now. Now, biblical laments generally follow a four-step process. Step one is to address God directly. It acknowledges God's presence and calls on God's power. Step two, then, is to present an honest complaint to God. And this can be a profound expression of sorrow or of deep pain or even of great anger about a situation. Step three, then, is to petition God to intervene. Ask God to bring deliverance to the one suffering. And step four, then, is perhaps the most crucial. Because this final step is to place one's trust in God to act, to rely on God to deal with the situation. Now, that's not to say that in lament we simply absolve ourselves from any responsibility against acting against injustice and just let God take care of it. No, that's not what I'm saying. What lament does is to emphasize that all of our actions will not bring about justice unless they are aligned with the actions of God. Lament is an admission that God is the one in control, and lament is a recognition that our actions then must be taken within the context of God's patient work, much as that gardener patiently waits for the tree to produce fruit. In describing it, Drew State says, the posture of lament not only centers on the need for justice, but also expresses humans' incapacity to effect it without God's help. Or to put that another way, lament is a way for us to humbly and patiently place our faith in God, trusting that God will ultimately deal with a situation. It is an alternative to the route of condemnation, a route in which we often seek vengeance and take matters into our own hands, forcing a solution on our timetable. Jesus' lament for this morning doesn't follow quite that same four-step pattern. It's a bit different structure. Because Jesus, as God with us, as the Word made flesh, addresses his lament not towards God, but towards the people of God. These are people who have repeatedly strayed from God, have rejected those sent by God, and yet God, in the person of Jesus, still reaches out to these people. After addressing the people, then he lifts up his complaint, and he grieves not only for those who have been killed, those who will be killed, but more so, for those who have not recognized the evil of their own actions. He mourns the fact that people have not responded to the invitation that God has given to them. He laments the failure of God's people to accept the love, the shelter, the home that God offers. And then he fervently gives his petition, a petition to these people to gather together under his protective presence, just as a mother hen gathers her chicks safely under her wings. Now, there is not, it may not be explicit here, but there is, I think, a very strongly implied expectation that God will act. Jesus expresses God's intent to continue to seek the people's redemption in spite of their obstinance, in spite of their misplaced loyalties. He foreshadows his own arrival in Jerusalem by quoting the words of the psalm that the people will be chanting when he gets there. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. And because we know that story, we know the ultimate outcome of his time in Jerusalem. We know that God does indeed triumph in the end. But of course, not before tremendous pain and terrible tragedy take place. So Jesus' lament leads him to a healthy, to a constructive response to the great calamity that he is facing. Because he's able to work through his own anger, Jesus does not seek condemnation. He does not look to destroy his enemies in hate, but rather to transform them in love. And that's something that is only possible through the power and through the presence of God. Drew State describes this transforming power of lament by noting that lament is acknowledging that things are not right, that things can be changed, and it is God's obligation to act. He continues, what's striking about prayers of lament is that they can be addressed to God about God or addressed to God about neighbor. Lament gives us permission to complain to God about God and to God about our neighbors and to ask God to change the situation. Now, we may not typically think of lament as an act of resistance, an act of transformation, but understood properly, it is a valuable tool in our struggle to live faithfully as citizens of God's kingdom in this world that so often collides with Christ. For it's through lament that we are able to move beyond anger and anxiety and condemnation. It's through lament we're able to move to affirm a higher allegiance to God over all the powers and principalities and presidents of this world. Through lament, we raise our voices in righteous anger over injustice and corruption and greed. Through lament, we place our faithful work before God, recognizing that we cannot succeed without God's guidance and God's help. And it's through lament we acknowledge our ultimate faith and trust in God as the one who will gain the final victory, the one whose kingdom will come, and whose will shall be done on earth as it is in heaven.